2 a.m. on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 45 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-40s. Then tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the low 50s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the upper 30s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the January issue of Cowboys and Indians magazine. The Real Deal. In 2021, we're seeking authenticity more than ever. These are a few of our favorite musicians, writers, and podcasters whose bona fides are indisputable. The Gospel according to Paul Cotham. The mostly, probably, reformed ex-con who turned 20 behind bars and had a hit with cocaine country dancing, transformed from pop slinger to righteous outlaw singer. By Scott Bedgood. In country music, The Real Deal is a title reserved for those who not only possess iconic voices, but who live the lifestyle they sing about, or, at the very least, make you believe they live it. Cash never served time in Folsom Prison, and while Murrow indeed turned 21 in prison, he wasn't doing life without parole, like he says on Mama Tried. But you believed them both when they sang about it. Paul Cawthon's got the voice. His rich, smooth, baritone voice earned him the nickname Big Velvet. And as far as the outlaw country lifestyle goes, when Cawthon sings about going to prison for getting caught with the devil's lettuce, he's not playing a character. His art almost always imitates his life. I turned 20 in prison, Cawthon, now 34, told me as we sat down at a picnic table on the porch of the Blue Store outside our shared birthplace of Tyler, Texas. But Cawthon is much more than a rebellious outlaw wringing the most out of life. He's also a deeply spiritual man walking the fine line between the sacred and the profane. The profane. The weed's under your seat, so if we get caught, it's yours, Cawthon says as we wind down East Texas back roads in his 1989 Dodge Ram Charger on the way to spend an afternoon on Lake Palestine. There's a reason Cawthon sells shirts that read country band with contraband. He was arrested in high school for possession of marijuana and after parole violations in college was imprisoned on a 6-month sentence. After his release, he moved to Colorado, where he says he began building on both his music and his outlaw careers. I started getting into that bluegrass hippie scene, taking a lot of acid and mushrooms and experimenting with my life, Cawthon says. I was just floating by the seat of the music and selling a lot of effing weed. He says he was part of a larger operation spread out across several states. But instead of splurging with the money he made, he began investing it in his music career. After several years in the Americana duo Sons of Fathers, Cawthon went solo. His 2016 solo debut, My Gospel, was an old-school country effort that shot him into the conversation with other non-Nashville country stars like Sturgill Simpson and Cody Jinks. But instead of riding the wave of success and fame brought with his breakthrough, Cawthon had a breakdown. A broken engagement sent him into a downward spiral. He lived for 2 years out of a suitcase at the Belmont Hotel in Dallas, driving himself into the ground even as he worked to create his next album, the brilliant Room 41, so named after the room where he almost died. I bought a Harley and I would drive it 120 miles an hour over the bridges in Dallas, Cawthon said. I'd wake up in the morning with songs in my voice, memos that I had no memory of recording. I was having to relearn my own shit and S blanking during the day. The result was an album that was an extreme departure from his first. Room 41 has funk, disco, and even some hip-hop beats, but Cawthon's undeniably country voice. The lyrics are sometimes personal, often vulnerable, and, like on the hit Cocaine Country Dancing, sometimes pure hedonistic fun. The Sacred. I thought, maybe I'm an apostle, Cawthon says, smoke blowing past his face as we zoom around in his 1983 Chris Craft boat on a windy summer afternoon. Cawthon grew up in the Church of Christ and still claims a Christian faith, even if that looks very different from the one he grew up in. My sermons aren't preached from a pulpit. They're preached on stages in venues all across the country. His apostolic realization came after he pulled himself out of his black hole, moved, and began a new relationship. As Cawthon tells the story, a homeless man asked to pray with him and quoted scripture from the Apostle Paul. When he learned Cawthon's first name, he began to cry. The interaction signified to Cawthon that he had a greater purpose in life. People think I'm this wild guy because I have a song called Cocaine Country Dancing, and I like that they think that, Cawthon says. But I also wait after every show and meet every single person that wants to meet me, and I say, God bless you, and thank you so much for coming. And you'd be surprised how much that means to people. These days, Cawthon is engaged to a woman he says saved him and changed his life. The June to his Johnny. They've moved back to Tyler and spend most of their days doing the COVID-19 lockdown out on the lake. He told me his next album will be about drinking beer with friends on the lake during the summer. Once again, Cawthon's art is imitating his life. Paul Cawthon approved country singers. Charlie J. Memphis, a 19-year-old with a mature voice well beyond his years. Memphis Cawthon produced debut album is due out in 2021. Lee Blevins. You'll swear Blevins is a long-lost daughter of Dolly Parton when you hear her voice. Cawthon says he produced her upcoming album as well. Until that is released, check her out on 2015 and 2018 EPs Running and Walking Home, respectively. Joshua Ray Walker, a Dallas-based country singer with the perfect twang, Walker is already on the road to stardom with profiles in Rolling Stone and shows with Shooter Jennings and Charlie Crockett. His albums are full of heartbreaking, honest lyrics. In 2019, he released a widely acclaimed debut, Wish You Were Here, and followed it up with Glad You Made It in 2020. He also released an album in 2019 with his band Ottoman Turks. The CNI Hot List. Yalla. It's no surprise that a great country voice comes from Bristol, except instead of Tennessee, Yalla is from Bristol, England. You won't hear a more authentic country singer from anywhere than the former backup singer turned Grammy nominee. Her debut album, Walk Through Fire, was produced by the Black Keys' Dan Auerbach. Yalla's country soul voice is on best display as a guest soloist on High Women, from the High Women's self-titled 2019 album. Charlie Crockett. A descendant of Davy Crockett, something he won't hesitate to emphasize, Crockett is a modern-day country and blues troubadour. He grew up dirt poor in South Texas, has lived everywhere from New York City to Paris to Northern California, and has risen to alt-country and indie stardom. His prolific output has seen him put out 8 albums since 2015. Peter Millsap. The Purcell, Oklahoma native with the boyish face has been writing mature bluesy and rocking Americana music for the better part of a decade. Millsap creates compelling, relatable characters in his music, from a veteran sticking up a quick trip to a zealous long-haul trucker trying to convert the prostitutes frequenting his truck. His music weaves a rich tapestry of the people who make up this country. It's not hard to pick up an influence of the Pentecostal church in his performances. Indigenous American music makers. Mildred Bailey. Mildred Bailey will take you on a melodious rediscovery of the best of vintage 1930s and 40s jazz. A favorite of Frank Sinatra's, she pioneered a vocal swing style that gave her handles like Mrs. Swing, the Queen of Swing, and the Rockin' Chair Lady, after her Hoagie Carmichael theme song, Rockin' Chair. Bailey was born Mildred Rinker in Idaho and grew up on the Coeur d'Alene Reservation, where her mother was an enrolled tribal member. The Indian songs of her youth shaped her style. I don't know whether this music compares with jazz or the classics, but I do know that it offers a young singer a remarkable background and training. It takes a squeaky soprano and straightens out the clinkers that make it squeak. It removes the boom from the contralto voice, this Indian singing does, because you have to sing a lot of notes to get by, and you've got to cover an awful range. That quotation and much more about her can be found in Chad Hamill's essay, American Indian Jazz, Mildred Bailey and the Origins of America's Most Musical Art Form, from the book Indigenous Pop, Native American Music from Jazz to Hip-Hop. If you'd rather just swing and not read, check out her music on YouTube and Amazon. No anthology really captures Bailey fully, but if you start with Rockin' Chair, It's So Peaceful in the Country, Fools Rush In, and Georgia on My Mind, you'll understand why so many future greats emulated her. By the way, she is credited with discovering Bing Crosby. Matt James. Matt James won the 2019 Native American Music Award for Best Country American Recording for an album that almost wasn't. The Mattagami First Nations, Ontario, Canada, musician had long been a hard-working bass player with Kanucky Bluegrass Boys and an award-winning songwriter. But James wasn't doing what his grandma Nouveau had encouraged him to do from an early age. Go and share that beautiful voice. That is your gift from the Creator. He nearly blew it his first chance to do just that when Nashville producer Kenny Royster called and James, thinking it was a telemarketer, hung up on him. Fortunately, Royster called back. The poignant part, the album is dedicated to and inspired by Matt's father, James Nouveau, a miner, who died just before Matt left for the United States to make the record. My dad came to me in a dream, and I was seeing through his eyes, James told Canada's Anishinaabeg News. He was connecting a detonator, and a big piece of rock fell and just missed him. His life was spared, and he dropped to his knees and prayed. And what he said are the lyrics to the song, word for word. A Miner's Prayer features that title track and 7 additional songs. Charismatic country that would make Grandma Nouveau proud of her boy. There's no Canada-U.S. border here. It's seamless proof of an authentic gift of a voice, recorded with a bevy of musicians who have played with big names like Sugarland, Taylor Swift, Big and Rich, Carrie Underwood, and Florida Georgia Line, along with backup singers who perform with Faith Hill and Tim McGraw. A Tribe Called Red. First Nations DJ Collective, a tribe called Red from Ottawa, Canada, makes big beat powwow step or electric powwow. Think electronic dance music that melds hip-hop, dubstep, and powwow. But it's more than a party on the dance floor. ATCR puts out positive messages ranging from indigenous self-identity to social solidarity to land sovereignty. Their 2019 Tonacumbia found the 2018 Juno Awards Group of the Year, collaborating with Quebecois powwow singer-drummer group Black Bear, along with Corpus Christi, Texas-based new cumbia DJ producer El Dusty, who brought his pioneering southern border sounds to the boundary dismantling track. Samantha Crane, Choctaw, has been a CNI favorite ever since we first introduced this to the Oklahoma multi-hyphenate artist, singer, songwriter, musician, producer. She has toured with the Abbott Brothers, among many others. After a series of car accidents and a long and harrowing recovery period, she came out in July 2020 with a small death. But start at the beginning of her discography and go total immersion. Be sure to Google a YouTube live performance of Red Sky, Blue Mountain to hear her sing in Choctaw and witness how, with just her spare guitar, unaffected voice, and genuine creativity, she commands the stage and transfixes the audience. Superman. Superman is an Absaluki rapper and fancy dancer born in Seattle. He grew up in Crow Agency, Montana. There's no way to describe the powerful impact of one of his performances. Just watch him on the YouTube performing live in a studio as he creates prayer loop song before your eyes and be prepared to pray or get prayed for. Levi Platier. Blues guitar aficionados will want to check out New Mexico's Levi Platero, Navajo, who grew up in his family band, the Plateros, and is now burning up the fireboard with the fretboard with a solo artist with the Levi Platero band. Gary Morin. There's so much we didn't know about phenomenal Americana blues musician and enrolled Crow tribal member Gary Morin, like the fact that the Colorado-based guitar virtuoso tours America with a 10-pound Shih Tzu named Zeus. If that doesn't immediately endear Morin to you, his new record, Dockside Saints, surely will. His 2017 Cradle to the Grave made some aficionados list of the top recordings of the year thanks to Morin's deft fingerstyle guitar and soulful storytelling singing. His acoustic Native American powers are in full flower on his new Dockside Saints, this time with a New Orleans flavor and featuring an all-star cast of top-notch players from the Lafayette, Louisiana area. Recorded at the renowned Dockside Studio in Vermilion Parish, it was produced by the multi-Grammy-winning Tony Daigle. The ancient native culture of the South has been an inspiration as it relates to our travels and what has become an annual pilgrimage to the Mississippi Valley, he says. As Celeste and I traverse this country, my eyes are flooded with landscapes and visions that gift me with an endless supply of songs. This new collection represents our annual migration, just as my ancestors migrated from this region to the Western Plains so many centuries ago, sharing culture through music and more along the way. It is the product of our imagination of what was and what has become our love of the sounds of the South. Western stories to watch. Nomad Land. By the time you read this, Frances McDormand should be generating high decibel awards buzz for her lead performance in Nomadland, another artful mix of fact and fiction from filmmaker Chloe Zhao. In the movie, inspired by the nonfiction bestseller of the same title by Jessica Brewer, McDormand, who already has Oscars to her credit for Fargo and Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, stars as Fern, a resilient 60-something widow who, after the economic collapse of her small Nevada town, embarks on a journey through the American West, joining the ranks of modern-day van-dwelling nomads. During on-location filming over 4 months in 7 states, McDormand and co-star David Strathairn were surrounded by real-life nomads, some of whom Zhao cast in supporting roles. Also on the cast, Bob Wells, the itinerant evangelist who offers spiritual guidance and practical advice to van dwellers. "One of the last things we filmed," Zhao told the Associated Press, "was Bob Wells' final conversation with Fern. The way he articulated this lifestyle, that there's no final goodbye, that I'll see you down the road, that really stuck with me. Zhao borrowed another line Wells speaks in Nomadland for the final on-screen title, dedicated to the ones who had to depart. News of the world. Tom Hanks aims to earn his spurs in his first Western, based on the novel by Paulette Giles, which reunites him with director Paul Greengrass. The 2-time Oscar winner stars as Captain Jefferson Kyle Kidd, a Civil War veteran who serves as the 19th century equivalent of a newscaster while traveling from town to town to deliver information about far-off events. He accepts a different sort of on-the-road assignment when he agrees to escort Helena Single, a 10-year-old taken by a Kiowa tribe 10 years earlier, back to her blood relatives. Complications ensue. Those Who Wish Me Dead. From prodigious and prolific multi-hyphenated Taylor Sheridan comes a neo-Western thriller, based on the novel by Michael Corrida, about a 14-year-old murder witness fleeing relentless assassins during a Montana forest fire. Angelina Jolie, Nicholas Hoult, Tyler Perry, and John Bernthal head the cast. The Harder They Fall. Idris Elba will be back in the saddle again for this Netflix Western co-starring Oscar winner Regina King. Zazie Beetz and Joanna Majors, it's a tale of pursuit and revenge focused on the efforts of outlaw Nat Love to track down the varmint, Elba, who killed his parents 2 decades earlier. Concrete Cowboy. Based on real-life events, this contemporary drama features Idris Elba and Caleb McLaughlin in a contemporary drama about an edgy father-son relationship set against the backdrop of the urban cowboy subculture centered in Philadelphia's North Street stables. Corsicana. Isaiah Washington does double duty as director and star for this Wild West adventure about legendary slave-turned-lawman Bass Reeves, whose real-life exploits reportedly were an inspiration for the fictions of The Lone Ranger. Rutherford Falls. CNI reader favorite Michael Greyeyes and Ed Helms of the Hangover movie trilogy head the cast of a new sitcom for the Peacock streaming device. The premise? Residents of a small town in upstate New York and a nearby Native American reservation find their lives disrupted when local legend and town namesake Nathan Rutherford fights the moving of a historical statue. Western Yarns and True Tales. Tecumseh and the Prophet, the Shawnee brothers who defied a nation. Peter Cozen's 2016 The Earth is Weeping won multiple awards for history books, landed on Best of the Year lists, including Smithsonian.com's top 10 history books, and was such a favorite at CNI that we had him write about his research for the book in our January 2017 issue. Needless to say, we were looking forward to the follow-up. 4 years later comes what could be considered a prequel of sorts to The Earth is Weeping, a biography of the Shawnee brothers Tecumseh and Tenskwatawa, who in the early 19th century managed to unite more than a dozen tribes against the physical and spiritual violence wrought upon them by American settlers, exploiting the lands they had recently won from the British. The book is also a corrective of previous histories that downplay or overlook the importance to the Alliance movement of Tenskwatawa's spiritual leadership. Far from an untalented fraud, a label with such other historians have dismissed him, he created an important spiritual and cultural doctrine that was as important to this intertribal unification as Tecumseh's brilliant leadership in diplomacy and war. Believe It As It Is, A Journey Through Theodore Roosevelt's American Wilderness. In Leave It As It Is, the author of All the Wild That Remains trips through the natural wonders of the West that awakened President Theodore Roosevelt's conservationist conscience, including the Dakota Badlands, Yellowstone, Yosemite, the Grand Canyon, and the site of a present-day showdown between native tribes who see it as a sacred place and supportive environmentalists versus energy companies who see it as a potential revenue source. Bears Ear, Utah. Next to The Last Stand, a Longmire mystery. Well, everyone knows Cassily Adams' painting, Custer's Last Fight, was destroyed in a fire at the 7th Cavalry headquarters in Fort Bliss, Texas in 1946. What this book presupposes is, maybe it wasn't. The latest Walt Longmire novel sends the sheriff on the trail of an art heist while investigating a shoebox containing $1 million in cash found in the possession of his recently deceased pal at the Veterans Home in Wyoming. Billy the Kid, a novel. A what-if western romp of a novel whose hero, a retired dentist claiming to be a mythic Wild West outlaw, faces down murderous bootleggers and corrupt lawmen in a small town during Prohibition. The Eagles of Heart Mountain, a true story of football, incarceration, and resistance in World War II America. During World War II, the United States government forcibly imprisoned 120,000 Japanese Americans in camps scattered across the West, including one at Heart Mountain, just outside Cody, Wyoming. There, the prisoners did their best to maintain a semblance of normal life, establishing schools, temples, sumo pits, kabuki theater, and other comforts to distract them from the racism, harsh conditions, freezing cold, and other hardships they faced. Then, in the fall of 1943, the camp's high school football team, the Eagles, had an incredible undefeated season, clobbering the predominantly white nearby schools. The next year, though, the young men faced their biggest challenge yet when they faced the decision of whether to join the Army or defy the draft in protest. Look for an interview with the author about the Eagles of Heart Mountain at acowboysindians.com. Indigenous Storytellers. Joy Harjo. Last year's literary light shines brightly on Tommy Orange, Cheyenne Arapaho. This year we're calling attention to some indigenous women's voices and can think of no better place to dive into the deep and refreshing water than Joy Harjo, Muscogee Nation. It's just not because she's learned to play sax at 40 while already an esteemed poet that we think this now 69-year-old phenom is a complete badass. Poet, musician, playwright, singer, actor, and author, Harjo is the incumbent United States Poet Laureate, the first Native American to receive the honor. She edited the revelatory 2020 anthology of Native poetry, When the Light of the World Was Subdued, Our Songs Came Through, which should be required reading for the title alone. Also essential reading, her 2019 poetry collection, An American Sunrise, and her 2012 memoir, Crazy Brave. But really, anything Harjo writes could go straight into the cart for an immediate checkout. And while you're clicking around, explore her award-winning CDs. Also, dig into her readings and other performances on YouTube. Kelly Jo Ford. Kelly Jo Ford, Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma, burst on the scene in late 2020 with Crooked Hallelujah and its linked stories about generations of Cherokee women fighting cycles of poverty and bad relationships. The book continues to get lots of love in the press for good reason. Who wouldn't want to keep reading a story that starts, when Lulu stepped into the yard, the stray cat, Justine, had just took off so fast it scratched her and sent the porch swing sideways. That the author has a dog named Sylvia Plath just makes you love her all the more and crave whatever she puts to paper. Louise Erdick. Louise Erdick, Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa, is a literary giant. Her prodigious output is smart, stunning, and enduringly, enlighteningly indigenous. Her intimate Birchbark Books and Native Arts in Minneapolis features works by and about Native Americans. On the shelves there, you'll find Erdrick's latest bestseller, The Night Watchman, which is based on her own grandfather. We can't do a better job of encouraging you to enter into its spell than Luis Alberto Urrea did in the New York Times Book Review. Erdrick delivers a magisterial epic that brings her power of witness to every page. We are grateful to be allowed into this world. I walked away from the Turtle Mountain Clan feeling deeply moved, missing these characters as if they were real people, known to me. In this era of modern termination assailing us, the book feels like a call to arms, a call to humanity, a bouquet prepared for us by hungry people. Cover story. Taylor Sheridan. We get up close and personal with one of Western entertainment's most important figures as he shoots scenes for Yellowstone's next season. By Joe Layden. Photography by Emerson Miller. Taylor Sheridan is on the phone, on the road. After wrapping up production on the fourth season of Yellowstone, his smash hit Paramount Network series starring Kevin Costner as the proud paterfamilias of the powerful Montana ranching family, the multi-talented writer, director, producer is on his way back to his native Texas, where he and his wife, actress-model Nicole Muirbrook, currently have two home bases. It's a long way from Hollywood, where Sheridan first gained prominence as an actor. His credits include continuing roles in the TV series Veronica Mars and Sons of Anarchy, and now visits mainly for meetings with the Supes about his writing and directing projects. Chief among those achievements, Sicario 2015 and Sicario Day of the Soldado 2018. Two explosive crime dramas about FBI agents tracking Mexican drug lords. Hell or High Water, 2016, a tale of Texas Rangers, Jeff Bridges, Gil Birmingham, on the hunt for bank-robbing brothers, Chris Pine, Ben Foster. Wind River, 2017, Sheridan's official debut as a feature film director, and the forthcoming Those Who Wish Me Dead, his second directorial effort, starring Angelina Jolie as a smoke jumper bent on protecting a teenage murder witness from hitmen during a raging forest fire. "I've been very fortunate," Sheridan says. "Everything I've ever made, we've shot the first draft of it. I've never been in a situation where I've been noted to death by a network or a studio. And so that freedom to sit down and just dream it up is a habit. And it's a habit that I embrace and try to feed as much as I can." With that in mind, you could view Sheridan's return to the Lone Star State as his way of going back to the well. Sheridan grew up on a ranch in Granfield's Gap, Texas, and has drawn heavily on his experiences there while ramrodding both Yellowstone and The Last Cowboy, an unscripted Paramount Network reality show in which real-life cowboys compete for a $1 million payday. "If I'd make a movie about an astronaut going into space," he says, "I'm making that movie for astronauts. For the astronauts to think, wow, that's exactly what it's like. Because if they believe it's like that, the rest of the audience will as well." So with Yellowstone and Last Cowboy, the authenticity of a situation is very important to me. After a photo shoot for our cover during filming for Yellowstone at the legendary Four Sixes Ranch in Guthrie, Texas, we were able to chat with Sheridan via cell phone for a stretch of his homeward journey. Here are some of the highlights from our conversation. "Sounds like you're going back to your Texas roots, literally as well as figuratively." "Yes, I live on a ranch outside Weatherford, and I've got another ranch out by Jacksboro." "And you doubtless have a writing room for yourself at each location, right?" "I've got little spots to write, yes. I left L.A. The second I could get out. My wife's from up in Wyoming, and my mother lives up there, so we moved there for a number of years until I finally convinced her to come try my home state. And I moved her to Texas on August 1st because I figured I might as well just pull the Band-Aid off quick. She didn't understand the heat for a bit, but then she figured it out, and now she's a Texan." "Can you tell us a little bit about your ranches?" "The main headquarters where we live is more of a horse ranch because I'm pretty deep into the horse deal. And then the ranch out by Jacksboro is more where we run the cattle." "How many head of cattle do you have?" "You know better than to ask that question." "But Taylor, this is Cowboys and Indians magazine. You know our readers want to know about that." "Well, I'm very fortunate in that I have some very nice Angus cattle. As far as my horses go, I supply most of the horses to Yellowstone, my TV show. And then I have horses that I show and breed. Right now, I've got probably as many horses as I have cattle, and I have too many horses." "Why do you think it was important for you to return to Texas?" "Well, it's different than any other place. Being a Texan today and what it means to live in Texas, there's a responsibility that comes with it in that you really do represent the entire state. Everybody in Texas always represents the state. And so there's a sense of class and confidence that I think every Texan seems to embody. And along with that, a respect for others, regardless of whether they agree with you or not. You respect their ability to disagree or agree. And there's a kindness in Texas that I find lacking in many other parts of the country. Anywhere you go in Texas, there is a genuine concern for another person's well-being. I just think it creates a structure of society that is very harmonious. I've got a lot of people that fly in to meet me from California or New York or wherever, and the first thing they say to me is, I can't believe how friendly everybody is. Everybody's friendly and everybody's so happy, I don't understand it. It's like, well, we're happy because we live in Texas, and we're friendly because we're happy. Let's backtrack a bit. You were doing rather well for yourself as an actor and had continuing roles in two successful TV series before you set your sights on a career at the other side of the cameras. What prompted the switch? I think the thing that really changed my perspective on my career was getting married and having a child, and then really thinking about how I'm going to raise that child. If that child is going to look up to me, what is he looking up to me for? It made me reflect on my career very deeply. Also, I wanted to tell stories that mattered to me and not tell other people's stories. I wanted to tell stories about my life and the lifestyle that I grew up in and the world that I came from, so people could understand where I come from and understand the value of the upbringing that I had. That's why I quit acting. That's when I started telling those stories that I felt mattered to me. How do you prepare to make the transition? I learned how to screenwrite by reading bad screenplays, which was basically my entire career. When I sat down to write my first screenplay, I said, I have absolutely no idea how to do this, but by God, I know how not to do it. So if I just don't do what everybody else is doing, it'll probably turn out okay. You scored your first big success as a screenwriter with Sicario, the 2015 thriller about FBI agents charged with tracking down a notorious Mexican drug dealer. Yeah, I'd been banging my head against the wall as an actor for 15 years, but I didn't have to bang my head very much as a writer. There were challenges, of course, but the business of Hollywood is such that they were very ready for the stories that I was telling. I don't think you could have gotten Sicario made 5 years before or 5 years after. But I happened to write that at a time when there was an appetite for it. The same goes for Hell or High Water. Once I sold that story, it didn't stress me much that I wouldn't be able to tell whatever I wanted. Something that stands out in your work as a screenwriter and director, from Sicario and Wind River to Yellowstone, and your forthcoming Those Who Wish Me Dead, is your ability to create strong women who can assert themselves in what are often considered men's worlds. Well, that's been my experience, right? My mother was a very strong woman. My wife is a very strong individual. My grandmother was a very, very strong woman. All the women in my family were very strong women who pursued their own careers. So that's all I've ever known. Let's go back to Wind River for a bit. The great director Howard Hawks once said the key to making a great movie is having three great scenes and no bad scenes. Yes, I agree. And my take is a movie has to have three great scenes and the rest just have to make sense. Wind River certainly is a great movie, and at least two of the great scenes in it involve Gil Birmingham, who previously appeared in Hell or High Water, and now co-stars in Yellowstone as Chief Thomas Rainwater. What do you think makes Birmingham such a valuable collaborator for you? Well, he's a very fine actor. He's really talented. You know, we auditioned a lot of other actors to play Alberto Parker in Hell or High Water. But there is a power and yet also a gentleness to Gil that I felt was very right for the role. When I wrote Wind River, I wrote that role with him in mind. And actually, I wrote an additional scene once I got him in it. When I wrote Yellowstone, well, I called him before I wrote it. Like, Gil, I've got a role that's right for you, buddy. I hope you come do this thing with me. And he said yes, and I was grateful. Before you committed to the Paramount Network, Yellowstone started out at HBO, right? That's correct. And I had written two scripts for them at HBO. But then I sat with the senior vice president of HBO, who told me that they weren't going to go forward with it. And when I asked why, he said, "Nobody wants to see this. Nobody wants to see a movie about this. And you don't understand why anybody is sitting out there in the first place. The whole thing should be a park." And I said, "Buddy, you're the exact reason I'm making this move." And then Paramount got hold of the script and read it and flew me down to L.A. They told me, "We want to make this. No development, no nothing. We want you to shoot it." And at that time, Paramount was really trying to rebrand from being Spike TV. They really wanted to push and become this premium cable outlet, but I didn't necessarily believe that they could do it. I said, I don't know if this is the right thing for you because it's so ambitious. I'm going to be so expensive. It's not going to make sense from a production standpoint. But they had such an appetite for it, they said, we're going to do this. And they did. Of course, as it turned out, we were both right. They were excited to do it, and it was as difficult as I said it would be, and as expensive and as challenging. But they trusted me. There were a few times, I think, when they covered their eyes and looked down, but they never said stop. And they did it the same thing this season. If you think about it, we were one of the first TV shows to start shooting again during this coronavirus. And you're just about finished with season 4 episodes? Yellowstone and Tyler Perry's TV shows were the first TV shows to film during this pandemic. And let me tell you, to put together a group of 200 people was very risky. But I told them, trust me, the whole thing takes place on a ranch. It's the safest place on earth, at least from the virus standpoint. So we did it, and they trusted me. They wanted to make the show as we've come to know it. Was Kevin Costner part of the project from the start? No, not when it was at HBO. But when I went to Paramount, he was. Kevin read the script, and we had a lot of conversations about where this would go and what we were going to explore. And with our agreement and our partnership, well, Paramount didn't want to let it go anyplace else. It's perfect casting for a number of reasons. The other members of the cast are professionals, of course, but you needed to give the impression that even they might be a little intimidated by him, correct? Well, in order to give John Dutton the weight that he needed, it had to be an extremely formidable actor. And there were only maybe 3 others that could have done it. But none of them could have done it as well as Kevin. I mean, look, Kevin's career spans 45 years, of course, but I really became fascinated with film as a young man, and at that time he was really beginning to dominate, as he still does, the industry. Whether it was with his character in Silverado or his character in Dances with Wolves. His open range is as good a Western as I've ever seen. And he made a movie with director Tony Scott and Anthony Quinn that's been extremely influential on me. So yeah, I've been a tremendous fan of his work for my entire career. And the opportunity to work with him now is, well, sometimes you've just got to pinch yourself. I assume you had something like a master plan right at the start about Yellowstone. Something like, if I get to do this for 3 seasons or 4, I want to do this, then I want to do that. And presumably, you have an end game in mind. I know this thing's going to go for a bit. I know exactly how it ends, and it's working towards that ending. How's that for a non-answer? Pretty cagey. But at what point did it really dawn on you that, hey, this isn't Dallas? When you figured, I've got to make an audience really care about a family filled with people who kill other people from time to time. I have to make every killing, whether you would call it homicide or self-defense, in some way justifiable. Otherwise, I just might lose the audience. Isn't that a risky balancing act during the run of a TV series? Look, I don't know the first thing about television. I don't know the first thing about how to produce a TV show, how to direct a TV show, and I'm not trying to ever learn. As far as I'm concerned, I'm shooting a 70-hour movie in a 1-hour increment. I approach it like that, and Paramount lets me. For me, this is less like Dallas and more like The Godfather. That was a drama about a family that did very bad things to protect its legacy. And yet, we care deeply for the characters. We never judge them for some of the malicious deeds that they did. So when you're storytelling, you're obviously going to heighten the drama and intensify the circumstances and create certain things, and you might question their plausibility in this world. But this show, any movie, is in an alternate world. And so you get to make your own rules in that world. As long as you're consistent in those rules, then the audience will accept them and embrace them. Of course, the most important thing to do is justify a character's position. It doesn't mean it's the right position, but justify every character's position. You have to really make the audience understand the point of view of everyone. Thomas Rainwater and John Dutton are in extreme opposition, and yet we very clearly understand their positions and why they take them. Okay, you're not going to give us any hints about what happens in season 4, are you? No, not a single one. Kind of figured that. But it's hard not to ask, considering how you finished off season 3 finale. That was kind of tricky, wasn't it? You weren't satisfied with just one cliffhanger. You gave us a row of cliffhangers there. A mountain range of cliffhangers. Well, you know what they say. You've got to break a few eggs to make an omelet. Season 3 of Yellowstone is now streaming on Peacock, and season 4 lands on Paramount Network in 2021. Those Who Wish Me Dead is planned for a 2021 theatrical release. Here are some interesting articles from the January 2021 issue of True West magazine. Ask the Marshal. On Gunsmoke, did the actors drink real beer? Yes, they were drinking real beer, and I'm betting it was cold. For whiskey, however, they used tea. Did Sam Bass ever work as a deputy U.S. Marshal before becoming an outlaw? A number of legends have sprung up about Sam Bass. He went to Texas around 1870 to become a cowboy. Despite some accounts referring to him as a sheriff's deputy, the closest he came to being any kind of a lawman was around 1870 when he took a job working as a farmhand for Denton County Sheriff W.F. Dad Egan. His duties included currying the horses, milking the cows, fixing fences, cutting firewood, and working as a teamster. Ironically, when Sam decided to become an outlaw, Dad Egan was one of the lawmen who pursued him. Did Wells Fargo have its own detective force? Wells Fargo hired undercover detectives like James Hume and Fred Dodge. In mining areas like Arizona, California, and Nevada, the company hired shotgun messengers to guard the gold and silver shipments. The agents routinely handled telegrams and money transactions as well. Did American Indians kiss on the lips as an expression of affection? It's difficult to get universal agreement among scholars on kissing. Some researchers believe that many American Indian tribes did not adopt kissing until after having contact with European settlers and Western cultures. In turn, Europeans learned it from the Romans, who got it from the Greeks, etc. Kissing is referenced in the Old Testament. Today, kissing is not practiced in 10% of the world. How did wagon trains keep law and order on the trail? The wagon master was the man in charge. He knew the trails and had experience getting through the trials and travails of the trails safely. In addition, most wagon train groups elected a council that held court for breaches of discipline. Usually the wagon master acted as judge, but it might fall to someone else of character or position, like a preacher. The cases they considered varied, but the council often settled disputes as well as judged people accused of crimes on the trail. The usual punishment for serious breaches of discipline, rape or murder, was banishment, firing squad, or hanging. It was estimated that in the peak year of wagon travel, more than 50 murders were committed. One of the most unusual stories of banishment was that of James and Margaret Reed. The couple and their children were members of the ill-fated Donner Party on their way to California in 1846. Trouble started when Reed took umbrage at a teamster named John Snyder for whipping an ox. The two exchanged words, then Snyder whacked Reed with his bullwhip. Reed pulled a hunting knife and killed him. A trial was held and Reed faced hanging, but was banished instead and forced to leave his wife and children. Ironically, Reed made it safely to California, and several weeks later led one of the parties to rescue the stranded survivors. How did cowboys working in the heat of summer stay cool in their hats? Well, they didn't. Straw hats were much cooler. However, most cowboys stubbornly refused to wear those hats, no matter how hot it got, as a substitute for their Stetsons. Many did wear lighter colored hats that wouldn't hold the heat as much as black ones. When did the practice of horseshoeing begin, and what was the purpose of doing so? Horseshoes date back to the domestication of the animals in Asia a few thousand years ago. Around 800 BC, at the beginning of the Iron Age in Central Asia, people began riding horses rather than using them exclusively as beasts of burden. The purpose of horseshoes is to protect the hoof wall from chipping or cracking. An early form of hoof protection used by the Asians was rawhide or leather. The nailed shoe is believed to have developed around 900 AD. Today, they're usually made of steel or aluminum, but specialized shoes include rubber or plastic.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, the Noon Book Hour, followed by the Coronavirus Update at 1.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas Community Update.
MCH creates phone line for health screening. Medical Center Health System is creating a phone line for patients to call for health screenings when presenting signs for COVID-19. Patients who are experiencing symptoms are being asked to call 432-640-2747. The phone line will be open from 9 a.m. to 8:30 p.m. Monday through Friday and from 10 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. Saturday and Sunday. If you have symptoms when the phone line is not open, patients are being asked to self-quarantine until the following day. As always, if it's an emergency, please call 911. Patients not at risk may be asked to self-quarantine at home until well or able to follow up with their usual health care.
This week on the Recording Library of West Texas Radio's Saturday Night Movie, in honor of Martin Luther King Day, we present Selma.
He's got supporters. Detroit, New York, Los Angeles, inciting large-scale arrests and sympathy marches.
I'm very aware of that, Mr. Hoover.
What I do know is he's nonviolent.
What I need to know right now, what's Martin Luther King about to do next?
Mr. President, Dr. King is here.
Mr. President, in the South, there have been thousands of racially motivated murders.
We need your help, Dr. King.
This thing's just going to have to wait.
It cannot wait.
You got one big issue, I got 101.
Summer it is.
You will not tolerate agitators attempting to orchestrate a disturbance in this state.
It is unacceptable that they use their power and keep us voiceless. Those that have gone before us say no more.
People actually say they're going to kill our children. They're trying to get inside of your head.
What happens when a man stands up, says enough is enough?
We build the path as we came, rock by rock.
This sail is probably bugged.
There are 70 million people watching. These pictures are going around the world.
We must make a massive demonstration. white, black, and otherwise. Come to Selma.
I heard about the attack of innocent people. I couldn't just stand by.
Looks like an army out there.
My eyes have seen the glory!
What happens when a man stands up, says enough is enough?
David Oyelowo, Oprah Winfrey, and Cuba Gooding Jr. star in the audio-described Selma. Saturday night at 7 on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 48 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-40s. Then tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the low 50s. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a low in the upper 30s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 12 noon.
It's time for the Noon Book Hour. Readings of books from all genres, handpicked by staff at the Recording Library of West Texas.